Hello, Niall. Welcome to In Your Nature podcast. My name's Ricky Whelan.
And I'm Niall Hatch, and it's great to be chatting to you again, Ricky, for our new season of our podcast. Thanks to everybody who's listening in and who writes such lovely letters and social media posts and everything and emails to us about this. It's nice to know that people like to eavesdrop on our chats about birds. As we often say, we'll be chatting about birds anyway, so it's nice that we get to share it with a wider audience. And no better time than the present then to mention that the In Your Nature podcast is produced in partnership with the Heritage Offices of Laois and Offaly County Councils, supported by the Heritage Council and the Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage. And this podcast is edited by Anne-Marie Kelly, who does an absolutely superb job, I think you'll agree.
Absolutely. So this opening the new season with a great topic, and we're going to talk about loads of brilliant birds. We're talking today about river birds.
Yeah, Ireland, I suppose, punches above its weight when it comes to freshwater habitats. We get a lot of rain in this country. We have a lot of rivers and streams. And there's a whole suite of birds that have evolved to live in specifically that type of habitat. And as you'll hear as we go through them, they're not really closely related to each other, but they do share this tie to the river systems, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah, and you know, they're vulnerable to their habitat as well, and the health of the rivers and all that sort of stuff. And when we get into it, I suppose we'll talk about how they're a biological indicator, if you like, of the health of those environments. And you know, when you see them, you know the river or the lake or whatever is in good shape. But so today we're going to talk about specifically five species, and they're all very charismatic and interesting in their own right. But the first one is flippant in its sort of charisma, and it's the kingfisher.
Yes, the kingfisher, the one bird I think maybe out of all of them, when beginning bird watchers are looking through their field guide and they see this thing that looks kind of out of place in Ireland in many ways, and think that's the one I really want to see. And they're quite widespread in Ireland. They're, you know, despite the bright colours they have, those bright blues and oranges, they're not as visible as they might seem, but they really do look like a piece of the tropics transported here to Ireland, which in a sense they kind of are, because they have an amazing range. Kingfishers are found all the way across from Ireland in the west, right across to through Japan and Taiwan and down to the Philippines in the east. So very widespread range, and in much of that range they're found in very tropical climates. But there's many species of kingfisher in the world, but this one, the common kingfisher, is the only one that we have across Europe, and indeed it's found here in Ireland, and a beautiful bird it is.
I think one thing I would point out to people that don't regularly see them or have never seen one, because I mean they bolt up and down the rivers like sort of lightning, and if you can't identify the call or you don't normally pick it up, you won't see too many of them, because they normally give themselves away as they're sort of barreling down the river and under the bridge. So I think we'll pause here for a second to listen to the call.
That's it. It's very distinctive. It's kind of subtle. You have to have your ear tuned into it. Yeah. But once you are tuned in, you pick it up. And, you know, I've lost count of the number of times I've been out walking with friends or family near a river or a stream, and I'm chatting to them, and all of a sudden I break off mid-conversation because I've heard this sound. I'm looking frantically around like I'm mad, and people are wondering what's going on because I've just heard the kingfisher going by. And it is the best way to find them. You're quite right, Ricky. Because despite the fact that the bird is so brightly coloured, it doesn't really stand out in its environment as much as you would think. So we have that that wonderful blue that they have on them, sort of metallic sheeny blue on top of their heads and along their backs and their tails. It might look like it's very, very visible, but it's an iridescent colour, so it needs to have light shining on it in order for it to reflect that light so you see it. And when that happens, you know, the bird would have to be in bright sunlight. When they're foraging and looking for their food, they're often hiding at the bank of a river underneath the shade of a tree or some branches. There's no light directly shining on them, so that blue doesn't really show. And by the way, what a blue it is. When you see it in proper sunlight, there's nothing like it in the natural world. I've never seen a photograph or an illustration that can capture it fully authentically. The cameras just don't seem capable of it. So you'll see many impressive photographs of kingfishers, but not really fully capturing just how spectacular they are in real life. And of course, they have that orange on the front of them, which when you see it on the white page of a field guide, really sticks out in contrast with that blue. But again, when that bird is nestled up on the bank of a river, perched under shade, it kind of blends in with the colours of the leaves and the earth and plants behind it, and doesn't stick out nearly as much as you would think. And the third thing, of course, is that in spite of just those bright blues and the oranges, the bird is also really small. It's a lot smaller than people expect. Kind of unusual shape, very blocky kind of bird, but much smaller than people are expecting it to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I would describe them as a boxy little bird, and this little square head and kind of, angler shoulders, if you like, but which fits with the sort of, I suppose, the international trend with kingfishers.
It does, yes. So there are many species of kingfishers in the world. Some of them look very like ours, or some that are even smaller. So a lot of them have these wonderful iridescent blues and have these oranges. But there's many other colours too. Some of them are very green in colour. A lot of them are brown and muted tones and shades of white and so on in them as well. And they, you know, that the fact is that although that there are many different sizes and colours, you would still instantly recognise all of those species as being kingfishers. They have this big angular-looking head, big dagger-like pointed beak that looks almost too big for them. This very upright body with their feet set very far back on the body, which gives them a very upright stance when they're perching. They have these amazing feet as well. These feet are what we call zygodactyl, which means they have two toes facing forward and two toes facing back. Now, the sort of standard or default arrangement for a bird foot is three toes forward, one toe back. But having two toes forward, two toes back, it actually means that they're better at perching, better gripping onto maybe swaying vegetation in a river or beside a river when they're looking down for their prey below. Their prey, of course, would be fish, but actually kingfishers across the world, some of them are found well away from water. They love to eat insects. Some of them even eat lizards. Possibly one of the most famous kingfishers of all is not found near water usually that much. That's the laughing kookaburra of Australia. That's a kingfisher, much larger than ours, with a very different call. But still, when you look at it, you realise actually it's got the same basic proportions as our kingfisher. It does clearly belong to the same family.
Yeah, my wife tells a story about a time when she was visiting Australia and a kookaburra took her sandwich straight from her hand. So it's not just gulls that do that, apparently.
No way, well, our common kingfisher in Ireland's going to do that. They're quite shy around people, so the sandwiches are safe at least.
Unless maybe you're having a minnow or a stickleback sandwich. The other thing about them, you mentioned their feet, but their legs are so short and tiny and they've got that foot arrangement, but their feet and their legs are not adapted for running around on the ground and hopping around. They're adapted for perching. So they've got really short, little strong legs and these really strong feet, but that's to sort of grip onto perches and fish from a perch, I guess.
Yes, exactly. This is a bird that you don't see walking around. They have no business walking around on the ground. On the rare occasions they have to do that, or maybe when they're by their nests, they shuffle along, but they're very ungainly on their feet. Very good flyers, of course, but they're really sort of ambush hunters. They wait and see what's coming below them. In many respects, their feet are quite similar in that regard to the feet of the common swift, which again is another bird that has zygodactyl feet and a bird that doesn't walk. They have very good grip with their feet, but they never actually land on the ground or perch on a wire or anything like that. And they have two toes forward, two toes back. Woodpeckers have a similar foot arrangement as well, and that helps them to anchor their bodies onto a tree. That again is a bird that doesn't spend very much time at all walking around the place. A lot of time gripping onto vertical surfaces, so it needs to have that extra grip. That evolution has provided that toe to move around the back to give them that extra support. That's exactly the same with the kingfishers. And the thing about their feet too, I'm not quite sure why this is the case, they're really bright things as well. You see these bright reddish orange feet. They really are quite eye-catching when you see them well.
They are. No, they're so heavily specialised, like the swift, that those features, you know, that they're really, really needed for their particular ecology. And another really interesting thing I love about kingfishers, the family, a lot of them can do this, is because they nest in burrows, they excavate in sort of the corners or the bend in a river or whatever, similar to the sand martin. They have, you know, they're at the end, the nest is at the end of this little tunnel, and they can turn their heads almost 360 or 180 to sort of look back, and it's to mimic or sort of, you know, feign that they're a serpent of some kind to scare away would-be predators. I think that's marvellous.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's great. And the thing, of course, because they nest in these tunnels, they are quite vulnerable. The taxon are going to come from one way. You know, they nest mainly on banks. It's hard for most predators to get up there, but sometimes something like a stoat might get in. And so they have this sort of this weird adaptation that they can bend around, like you said, so they can see off any kind of predator, or maybe make them think it's not worth hassling them because they think somehow it's a snake or some sort of other predator like that. And indeed, kingfishers, when you see their chicks in those nests, they do look very reptilian. They're you know, the adults are beautiful. I think that the chicks themselves are perhaps the ugliest of all the birds that you'd see. There's something really prehistoric. They look almost like little pterodactyls. They're all sort of scaly and leathery looking, like little lizards, and until their feathers grow in, of course, and then they have this beautiful appearance. The eggs are interesting too. The eggs are pure white, and because they have no need for any camouflage, they're down the end of a tunnel in a riverbank, so they're not going to be seen by predators anyway. So they don't need, the female birds don't need to invest all the resources resources in basically painting the outside of the eggshells with these colors inside their oviduct that many other birds do that are less camouflaged. So this is, the tunnels do offer great defense, but sometimes if a predator does get in, you have to have these novel ways of chasing them back out again.
Yeah, totally. And it's really bizarre when they do it. I've been lucky enough to have them in the hand when we're studying them in different sites, and they just do that sort of exorcist style sort of head twist, and it's really quite bizarre, but it's good to know its origin and what it's for.
Whenever I see a kingfisher along a stretch of river, it always gives me a nice warm feeling, because they're really important indicators of the overall health of the environment, because kingfishers, like a lot of the birds we're going to be speaking about now in our river bird program, they are birds that rely on clean water, so they wouldn't be present there if the water wasn't in really good condition. So taking a kingfisher as an example, they can only live in and around water where, first of all, it's clear enough that they can see their prey. They're looking for little fish and tadpoles and things swimming down below, so they'll be able to dive in to get those. If the water's murky or full of algae or whatever, they won't be able to see their prey, so they won't be able to feed on it. And then secondly, of course, the water has to have, it has to be clean enough, lacking pollution, so that these creatures can survive there in the first place. So when you see a kingfisher, it's a sign that the health of that particular waterway is probably fairly reasonable. And that's one of the reasons why in Birdwatch Ireland we study species like that, to get an indicator of the overall health of the local environment.
Absolutely. And I think lastly, I think a feature that is worth mentioning as well is their relatively long and very sharp spear-like bill, which is obviously a modification for diving and hunting and stabbing at fish like the heron or whatever.
Yes, it is. It is very, very sharp. It looks almost outlandishly large on their heads, and it's the main way that they find their food. And what they do is they'll wait on a branch or a perch, looking down. Occasionally they'll hover even. They will dive from flight, but it's not that often you see that happening. They prefer to be on perches. They plunge straight into the water. They grab that fish. What they do then is they'll take it out, and they'll then bang it repeatedly on a branch or a stick or stone or something to kill it, and then they turn it around, and they always swallow it head first so that the scales don't splay out and get stuck in their throat, so it helps it slide down more easily. With that bill, actually, one of the interesting things is that you can tell the difference between the male and the female by the colour of that bill. So yeah, it's one of the few examples in Ireland where the female actually is a bit more colourful than the male. The male has an all dark bill. It looks black or very, very dark grey, whereas the female, the upper mandible is dark, but the lower mandible has this reddish kind of glow to it, which is pretty interesting. So that's a way you can tell the male and the female apart. And the other thing, the other great adaptation they have when they're hunting is that they're actually able to judge the angle of exactly where that fish would be, because water will bend light. It's a different refraction angle between air and water. So if you're looking down into the water and you see a fish or a coin or whatever it might be, and you want to grab it, you might stab your hand in, try find it, but you'll miss it because it isn't where it appears to be to our eyes, because as the light rays are reflecting from it coming out of the water, they're bending at that angle, and the human eye doesn't compensate for that. The kingfisher's eyes and brain automatically compensate for that. So when they're diving in to find their food, it might look like they're going at the wrong angle, like they're going to overshoot it, but actually they know precisely where that fish is and they're deadly accurate. So that surprise, that accuracy, and that sharp beak are essential to their hunting. They don't have time to practice, and they have to only one strike to get that fish, so they have to make sure that they're accurate, and that beak is the perfect weapon to do that.
A second one is a bird that you never see away from a river. They need fast flowing, sort of gurgly water, as it were, and they're another fascinating species. Not quite the sort of flash harries that kingfishers are, but it's the dipper.
Yes, the dipper, a bird that their entire lives revolve around fast flowing streams and rivers. As you said, it's a bird you won't really find away from there. The dipper, a lot of non-bird watchers might not know it because it's so specific in its habitat. It's very widespread within Ireland, but if you don't know where to look, you won't find them. So it's kind of, in many ways, it's kind of a dumpy looking bird. To me, it looks a bit like an oversized wren with a short kind of stubby tail, a very rotund body. Almost looks like they have no neck. It's kind of stuck onto their heads. But what they do is that they have a very, very dark brown body. It looks almost black from a distance, but with a large white bib coming down from their chin and down onto their breast. And that is quite distinctive. So very often, if you're looking along the river, you'll see this almost blackbird-like bird, a bit squatter and shorter with a truncated tail, with this big white bib on the chest of it. And always, again, around fast-flowing rivers. And the best way to find them, actually, I always go along a river and I look for where the weir is or wherever the white water is at its roughest. And at the very point, you think, that's far too rough for any bird to be there. That's exactly where it'll be. They want to be in the very roughest, most turbulent parts of the stream.
The name is fascinating, or the English name, the common name, in that they're called dippers, and they're sort sort of two, I suppose, two reasons you could call them that, and maybe two arguments of which reason they're called it for. But one is they do this lovely dipping dance nearly all the time. They do this kind of when they're on rocks dipping away. And the other thing is obviously they're dipping in and out of the water after caddisflies and insects like constantly. So where do you lie on the, or which side would you lie on?
I think it's appropriate in both ways, isn't it? They do have that sort of dipping action that they do, which as well here as we go through our other water birds, that's a common theme among water birds or stream, you know, river birds. They seem to do this. And that might be part of it. I know that the Irish name is particularly appropriate. The Irish name is Scawa Dove, which means black Smith, and I think it's that repeated backwards and forwards movement, like a blacksmith hitting a piece of iron on an anvil with a hammer back and forth, that sort of repetitive action. But it really is interesting because their claim to fame of the dipper, I suppose, is it's there's only five species of dipper in the world, and we only have one in Europe, this one with the white breast and throat. They're also found in throughout Asia. You have dipper species in North America and South America as well. Those five, they're the only aquatic songbirds in the whole world. So all the other songbirds, and that's the biggest group of birds, half of all the bird species in the world are songbirds, but the dippers are the only ones that actually go into water habitually to find their food. And it's really funny watching them do that, because unlike most water birds, they don't really swim. What they do is they just jump into the water, then they sink down to the bottom of it as fast as they can. They go down to it, and then they use their feet to grip onto the substrate, the stones or wherever it may be down the bottom of the water, and they walk along there methodically, looking for their food. And then when the time comes to breathe, or they're finished eating or whatever, they just release their feet, they bob back up to the surface of the water like a cork, and they use that fast flowing current to carry them along until they get to the next little rock or maybe near the bank, and then they just hop out. So rather than swim, they just let the current carry them, which is pretty interesting, I think.
Because they do that, their feet have developed to be so super strong, and I've been on the receiving end of their sort of squeezes and pinches from their feet when we're out ringing them. And our old colleague, our past colleague, Alex Copeland, has been doing a long running study of dippers in the Slieve Bloom Mountains on the Leash and Offaly side. And we've had hundreds and I'd say Alex had thousands of dippers in the hand, and learned a lot about the Irish dipper. But there's a couple of strange features. The other strange feature is about they blink sideways. Tell me about that. I've seen the flash of this thing, and it's bizarre. It's alien-like.
It is, yeah. It does look kind of freaky. And in fact, many birds do that, perhaps most birds. They have this, except in most birds, this eyelid, or to give it a proper name, it's their nictitating membrane, is transparent. So you don't see it when they blink. And this is a reptilian feature that we see in some species of reptile as well. So it shows how birds and dinosaurs, how they're connected. But for some reason on the dipper, this sort of third eyelid, this membrane, is white and opaque. So when they blink, you see it flashing across the eye. It does look really weird. You just see, when you first see it, you think, did I actually see that? And then you realize, mm-hmm. Yeah, they do this all the time. Nobody's quite sure why they have this white eyelid when other birds don't. It's thought maybe it's a signal to each other, but nobody's quite sure. It does seem kind of strange. So that is one of the most eye-catching things about them. You mentioned there as well about the Irish dipper, and we should say that the dipper is a special bird in Ireland because it's one of only just a handful of bird species where we have a unique Irish form or an Irish subspecies that's different from the ones that you find elsewhere. So it's actually a little bit different from the ones in Britain and the ones on the continent. And genetic work has shown actually that Irish dippers are more closely related to those found today in Iberia than to the ones in Britain. So it may be some sort of post-glaciation thing, maybe part of that Lusitanian flora and fauna that we hear so much about. Things like the strawberry tree, for example, would be another one. The Kerry slug and other species. And perhaps the dipper then as well, or at least the form of it that we have.
I also find their breeding ecology and some of their stuff around their rearing their young and how they nest and all, very unusual as well. So they nest quite early, very early March to build a nest. I know that we used to start checking the nest for eggs at on St. Patrick's Day. So that's how sort of early on in the year that they would have eggs in the nest. So we'd normally say the first eggs on St. Paddy's Day. It's an easy day to remember. The nest is fascinating. It's like a basketball size ball of moss. So think about a wren's nest, if you've ever seen a wren's nest, everyone. And multiply that up to basketball size and a wet basketball dripping underneath a bridge somewhere in this cavity in an old put hole, if you know what that is, under an old stone bridge up a mountain somewhere. Like they've picked some bad places to nest, but the nest itself is weird.
It is, and it's strange that it does seem to be so damp all the time. I mean, on one level not, I suppose, because they're always near fast flowing water, so they do get sprayed with that. But normally birds would try to avoid water getting into their nest. Somehow the dipper seem to cope with this in a way that other birds just can't. The bridge does give them some form of shelter, but not as much much as you'd think.
Yeah, and it's a giveaway if the nest's been used, because they will leave the nest behind and build a new one, or sometimes they'll return to the old one or whatever. But you can, if you see a nest, a dipper nest under a bridge, and you can see it sopping wet, you can almost see the dripping water out of it, you know it's active, and it's a good sign, you know. But anyway, don't approach a nest as the, without a license as it is, or what, you know. The chicks are phenomenal as well now, that in that they jump straight out into the soup and off they go. Like, and
yeah, first, the very first thing they do. Yeah, absolutely. Their lives just revolve around the water. They just leap right in and off the current will carry them, and their parents will call and they'll come back out. It really is quite remarkable. And a good place to look for that is around old stone bridges. That's where they would like to nest. One of the issues is often is with modern bridges and the constructions, they don't leave so much space for dippers to nest. And I think that's a real shame, because it's actually very easy to accommodate a dipper. I know in parts of Germany, for example, by law now on bridge developments, when they're putting in concrete pillars for them, they have to put in this special mold into the concrete that makes the lovely shape of a dipper nest, perfect platform for them. Doesn't cost anything to do it. It's an absolute doddle to do, and yet it benefits that species greatly. I know that though artificial nest boxes under bridges can have real benefits here in Ireland. We do see that working quite well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And isn't that a lovely idea in Germany, and very, you know, cost effective and everything. And the problem with boxes is, and we've put up again, Alex has put up hundreds of them, and other sort of conservationists have too around the country, all over the place, where the bridges don't suit them naturally. But the problem is, the first sort of flood that comes down and, you know, there's a tree in the flood, it just takes the box straight off the bridge. You know, it'll just clatter it and pull it off or damage it. So boxes aren't the best solution. They definitely work, but certainly a concrete mould into the structure would be ideal. And it's something we should definitely advocate for in this country and further afield. It's a deadly idea. So, yeah. And I mean, like the chicks, yeah, straight into the soup. Once they do jump out of the nest, they're pretty independent. The parents will feed them for a while, but they get fishing straight away, and they're kind of almost a grey blue. The chicks, they're strange to look at first until
they molt.
Until they molt, yeah.
Absolutely, they do look quite different from their parents. This kind of scaly effect, and they can be quite secretive at that time too, because they're learning the ropes. One good way to find dippers and see if they're present on a river often is to look for what we call the whitewash that you find on the rocks. So often you'll see like a prominent rock in a stream. If it has lots of bird droppings on it, there's a good chance that they belong to a dipper or were put there by a dipper that was on the stream. And another good way to find them, of course, is by listening for their call. Again, as with the kingfisher, the call is one of the best ways to sort of track the ear in. You know, the bird watchers tuned into this and find out where they are. And if you do, you might look over the bridge and then you see this thing whirring by, this blur of wings as they go past so quickly. So maybe we could hear the call there and so people know what to listen out for.
Yeah, people should get out sort of after listening to the podcast and try experiencing all singing, all dancing dipper. It's a really nice thing to see. You do still hear them calling it this time of year, so it's worth a go. They're fascinating. There's another species quite closely linked. So they've got, you know, they're similar to the dipper where they choose to nest, in the fact that they do a little dance themselves. And you guessed it, that's the grey wagtail. Tell me about those.
They're one of my favourites, actually. I think they're one of the most inappropriately named birds in Ireland, maybe with the exception of the purple sandpiper, which doesn't look purple in any way. Because when you see a grey wagtail, the first thing you notice is, my goodness, that thing is bright yellow. And they really are. They're this lovely, vivid yellow below. They are grey on the back, of course, and on top of the head. The males in the breeding season have this lovely black throat patch that the females lack. So in the summer, you can tell the male and female apart. It's a bit trickier in the winter when the males mainly lose that patch. So the reason why people sometimes, when they see them, they report them to us as being yellow wagtails. There is another species called the yellow wagtail, which is a lot scarcer in Ireland. It's by no means as closely tied to waterways as the grey wagtail is. It's just a rare breeder and a rare passage migrant in Ireland, but it is vividly yellow. It's like, it looks like a walking dandelion in a field. It just screams at, you know, you see this here. So the grey wagtail, while it's not as vividly yellow as that, I still do think that the name grey gives it a bit of a disservice. It's much more colourful than the name suggests.
You will see them away from streams. You see them at lakes. You see them in any sort of freshwater areas and a little bit further afield away from the river than a dipper. But similar ecology, they'll feed on the edges of the rocks for insects that are hatching on the river, the waterway. And they nest in similar locations, quite close to water, not always over it, but often in pipes and stuff, drains that are leading off into rivers, under bridges, in cavities, in walls, all that sort of stuff. And they're insectivorous as well, and they're just lovely. And they like the pied wagtail, they're very close relation, the willy wagtail, as people will know them. They're constantly doing that tail wag.
Yes, and nobody knows why they do that. It would seem to be a complete waste of energy, but yet it must confer some sort of advantage on them because all the species of wagtail in the world do this. And it's probably most noticeable in the grey wagtail because it has such a long tail. So for those who know the willy wagtail or the pied wagtail, it has a long tail, but the tail of the grey wagtail is even longer again. And it just seems they're incapable of standing still. That tail bobs up and down all the time. One of the theories I've heard is that it may be something that would mask the bird against the fast-flowing water going by. I'm not sure if I really buy into that, because actually it often makes it even more obvious. It's often the thing that first draws the eye in, is this moving tail. So I'm not sure. It's one of those mysteries. Nobody's quite certain why they do that. But you often will see them walking along the shore, the edge of a river, maybe on rocks in the middle of it. Unlike the previous two species you mentioned, the dipper and the kingfisher, the grey wagtails don't generally go into the water itself. They may wade a little bit in the shallows, but they prefer to be in the dry bits along the bank, or sometimes they'll even catch flies that are congregating over the river. You see them flying up and catching flies, which looks kind of awkward, actually, because they don't look like birds that were designed for catching food in flight the way, say, a flycatcher would. But somehow they manage it. And it's quite endearing to see them. And also, another thing that's endearing about them is they're probably less shy around humans than most of the other water or river birds that we would think of. You will see them sometimes in urban areas. They come into suburban gardens. And they tend to let you get much closer than, say, a dipper or a kingfisher would. Usually, at the first sight of a human, a dipper or a kingfisher will scarper. Whereas the grey wagtail, they'll probably just suss you out and walk around a bit and not really paying you too much heat.
Yeah, no, totally. And here's a genuine question. We haven't teed this up, so it could be a very short answer, it could be a very interesting answer, I don't know. But like their cousins, the pied wagtails, which form these huge roosts in the winter where you can sort of have, you know, 100, 150 of them in a small tree in an urban street, do grey wags form small roosts in the winter? Do we know anything about that?
I think they do to some extent. Not as large as the ones of the pied wagtail, but I know that they do go into reed beds sometimes. So you will get groups of them congregating together. Okay. Again, it's thought it may be something to do with safety in numbers, more pairs of eyes looking out for danger, that kind of thing. But the flocking behaviour isn't as strong as it is for pied wagtails, which can be truly amazing when you see those birds. As you said, sometimes hundreds of them in a tree, or I sometimes see them on the roofs of service stations along the motorway and stuff like that, wherever they can find together. And this is something you see with other wagtail species around the world too. They tend to be quite gregarious, so yeah, you will see some groups of grey wagtails, but usually not to the same extent you would as the pied wagtail.
We better listen to their calls so people can tune their ear in for that when they're down the river as well.
That's quite a distinctive one, actually, this two-syllable call that they have. It's reminiscent of the call of the pied wagtail, but something a bit sharper and more insistent about it. That's something actually we find quite a bit with river birds, that their calls tend to be short and sharp and high-pitched. And that seems to be an adaptation that allows them to cut through the noise of the river and all the turbulence that you get there with that too. So it kind of sticks out. And with most of the birds we've been talking about so far, that call will usually be down near the river. With the grey wagtail, they could be flying over quite high. They will go to quite to some altitude sometimes. So you see them sometimes flying between areas while calling way above your head. So if you hear that call coming from overhead, and that you look up, and you may well see this long-tailed yellow-bellied bird going over, and that's your grey wagtail.
The local to me, there's a lovely little spot. It's a picnic area, and it's on the Nore there, and there's a tiny little village sort of in South Leash or heading down that way. It's called Castletown, and it's got a lovely weir and fish ladder and all, to let the salmon and the trout sort of migrate and all that sort of stuff. But there you can get four of the five species we're talking about today in one place. And that's, you definitely see kingfisher there, dipper, regular, grey wagtail like stalwart, and sand martins in the summer as well. And I've never seen a common sand there, not saying they don't arrive, but the four are pretty regular, and it's nice when you get gets a sight like that. I'm sure there's plenty in Wicklow. I could think of others along the Nore, like Bennett's Bridge and all, where you have a similar setup, that you'll definitely get the four as well.
And that's a sign that particular location is in a really good healthy state, because you couldn't support those varied types of water bird and river bird unless there was enough food around, unless the water was clean enough, unless there was enough shelter, enough nesting opportunities, all of that. So that's usually a good sign that habitat is in pretty good condition. That's really good to see. So when you find a place like that, it's always worth spending a bit of time there, because you could see some other rarer birds there as well. If it's good for those birds, it would be good for other species as well. So that's the kind of place that bird watchers want to find.
So let's move on to San Martin.
Yeah.
so-called because they traditionally nest in sort of a bend in a river where there's a sand cliff has sort of happened by true erosion, quarries, cliffs, even key walls and stuff. You'll find them in and historic buildings. They will go in there as well in the cavities there. But traditionally, they'll be in the bank of a river or whatever. Great little birds. They're gregarious. You find them in numbers. Tell me about them. Describe them for us.
So they're, again, quite different to the birds we've been discussing so far in this episode. They are members of the swallow family. And if you get a good look at one, you'd realize that is quite swallow-like. They have a forked tail. They have very long, pointed wings, which means that they're very maneuverable in the air and very good at flying quickly. They have a very short little beak, but they can open their mouths nice and wide, so they can grab lots of insects, and they forage in flight. They catch flying insects in flight, just like a swallow does. However, they look a bit different from our barn swallow, the typical swallow we have here in Ireland, in that the colour is very different. So a swallow would be very, very dark above. Looks black from a distance. Up close, you see it's actually a really dark, glossy blue on the top of the head and along the back. Long tail streamers as well, which the sand martin lacks. And then the swallow is white below with a red face. Whereas the sand martin, it's a lovely sort of sandy brown colour above. They've got a shorter tail, again, without those tail streamers. And then below, they're gleaming white, except for this sandy brown breastband that goes across the chest. And that can be quite visible. And you'll often see them swooping low over the rivers, going back and forth, up and down. And they're migratory birds. So they're one of the first migrants to arrive with us in Ireland. They're only here to breed during the summer, but they arrive usually around St. Patrick's Day. They're one of three early migrants I often associate with that time of year. When you see your sand martins, your sandwich terns, and your wheat ears arriving around mid-March. So they spend quite a bit of time with us. And this is a very successful species. They're not just found here in Ireland or in Europe. You find them all across Asia and North America as well. And then they migrate into the southern climes when they go to those countries as well. Any of our listeners who may be in North America, we know we have quite a few people listen to our podcast there, they have the same species. They would know it better by a different name, though. We call it the sand martin. They call it the bank swallow. So it's exactly the same bird. And the ones in North America, they'll migrate down to the Caribbean and to South America for the winter. So it's a very similar strategy. It just shows how successful this bird is. You find it all across the world. It must be doing something right.
Absolutely. I wish we had this conversation before I visited America the last time. Because I was there, they have a lot of martin species that all look kind of vaguely similar. And if you don't know the size of them and you know the habitat you find them in, they can be quite confusing. But now I know that. They're insectivorous as well. So the river, I suppose, the benefits are why we call them river birds is twofold, in that they will nest in the bend of a river or whatever. But they're also hawking for insects constantly. So if you want to find the hirundines, which is the martins and the swallows, that family of birds, you'll often find them over a water body. And again, it harps back to the initial message of this episode, in that if you have a nice, a good quality water waterway, you'll have plenty of insects, because it's a good indication that the environment is in good shape, that the food web is working out as it should, and all the linkages are there in place, and that apex predators that the birds are in their own habitats and their own niche, everything's working out for them.
That's it, exactly, yes. And it makes sense that these birds would hunt over water, because so many insects will emerge from that. There's lots of, especially in the spring and the summer, you see many, many insects coming out of the water. And there's not many birds that are agile enough to be able to catch those. So when you see the swallows and the martins, and also swifts will do it too, swooping low over the water, they're getting insects in flight that other birds just can't access. So that means they have a lot of it to themselves, and they do very, very well. And I love watching sand martins, particularly when they're going over the water. Sometimes you see them dip down, and actually their beak, their lower mandible, will just scoop into the water. Sometimes it's because they're taking a drink of water, or sometimes it's because they've spotted a little insect on the surface of the water and they just scoop it up. So the agility that, you know, that they have to do that, it far surpasses that most birds would have. And it's a treat to watch them. They're a treat to listen to as well. And often you'll see these big gregarious colonies together, or when they're feeding, they make this constant chattering kind of call. So maybe we'll hear that now and people will know what to listen out for.
Yeah, I describe it as a squilch, and it's, I don't know how else to describe it really, but it's a nice call. And you know, other than the house martin, it's hard to mix it up with anything. They're busy. They're busy animals. I mean, like, they can have two or three broods in a summer, and you know, they're kept going. They don't wait around to recover. They don't get lazy and head back to to Africa or anything like that, once they've got the first brood fledged, they'll just repeat until they run out of time and insects, basically.
That's it. Yeah, exactly. So that they want to make the best of the summer season to produce as many young as they possibly can, because it's something that's a common problem for lots of these trans-Saharan migrants that, you know, head to southern Africa each year. It's that the vast majority of their chicks die in the attempt. Most don't survive. So those, the parents need to make sure that they produce enough offspring to that at least two will survive over the course of their lifetimes to eventually replace their parents in the population. So life is very tough for them. And I always have this huge respect and regard for these tiny little migratory birds that go to such great lengths to fly those distances. And one of the strategies that they use in order to try and be as productive as possible to make sure their chicks survive is where they choose to nest. So as we said, they nest by excavating a tunnel, usually in a riverbank, or sometimes maybe in a quarry, or sometimes you see them on loose sea cliffs as well. But this also means that they're very prone to summer flooding. That can be a big problem if the nest holes flood, and then the chicks will drown or the eggs will chill, and there's no getting around that. But also they're very very susceptible to erosion. Sometimes they'll arrive back from Africa and find out that the riverbank or the cliff where they had nested the previous year, or maybe had nested for the previous 20 years in terms of that colony, has collapsed and it's gone. So they have to excavate new tunnels or find somewhere else to live. So they're often on the move, and when a colony gets disturbed, it can be really, really destructive for them. It can be very hard for them to re-establish somewhere else because the habitats where they nest are becoming fewer and fewer.
So yeah, no, they're great birds, they're great. So let's move on to the next part, which is different in sort of appearance, in ecology and life sort of strategy, if you will. It's another migratory species, and it's the common sandpiper.
Yeah, and the name is a bit misleading here as well, because it's not terribly common. In the winter particularly, you'll see other wading species being a lot more common than this one is, and indeed you won't see this bird in the winter at all, because it's quite unusual. Ireland has lots of waders, lots of the shorebirds, as they're called in North America. And we have several breeding species, birds like lapwing, redshank, curlew, they breed here. A lot of our breeding waders doing very poorly, of course. We've discussed that in the podcast before. We get a huge number that come in just for the winter. So Ireland is one of the best places in the world, I think, for waders during the winter, and indeed on passage when they're migrating in the autumn and the spring. But there's just one species of wader that migrates to us in the summer to breed, but then leaves us for the winter, so you don't find them at all, and that is the common sandpiper. They breed in Europe and they winter in Africa. So quite a different lifestyle, and a bird that you often would see usually around the shores of rivers, the edges of lakes, usually where there's quite a shallow bank, where they'll wade around in the shallows. Like most waders, they have that similar sort of body shape and structure. They have a fairly long pointed beak, fairly long legs to allow them to wade in mud and in water. But a bird, again, yeah, you just see here during the summer, and tends not to be seen around estuaries and mudflats and places like that where we would normally associate with waders.
I'm used to seeing my waders in their hundreds and thousands in, you know, tightly sort of grouped packs or flocks or whatever. But you're lucky to see two, and really lucky to see three along a river if you're really blessed. But they're lovely little things. I mean, we should probably describe them. So the other birds we're talking about are kind of, you know, your standard little robin sized or around that thing, but these are, you know, a bit larger, long-legged wader with a long bill. And I suppose you're always better at describing the species than me.
Well, I think you've done a great job there. They're kind of, you know, they're kind of a greyishy brown colour above. From a distance, it looks quite uniform. Up close, there's this lovely sort of intricacy in the plumage. They're very white below, and they have this wonderful sort of swirl, I suppose, extension of that white up from the breast, up around sort of, we've imagined like the shoulder kind of area of the bird, sort of peeks up into it and intrudes into it. And that's actually a very distinctive characteristic on this bird. It really draws the eye in. You do see that quite a bit, and it's not something you see on other more, you know, other waders you might see in similar habitats.
Sometimes you get green sandpipers, and if you're very lucky, a wood sandpiper, but you can immediately sort of rule those two out when you see that shoulder patch, as it's called, that white thing just extending beyond the shoulder of the wing or whatever. Very handy. And they have that typical sort of, you know, yin and yang style wader pattern, that they're white below and sort of greyish above. And that's an adaptation, is it not, to help them sort of avoid the likes of the peregrine?
Yeah, that's it. You see, so a lot of birds that are associated with water tend to be pale below and darker above. And that's camouflage from above. So predators like peregrines or whatever looking from above won't see them. They'll blend in well against the riverbank or the water, wherever they happen to be. But if they're pale below, it means that they're potential prey in the water. And when they look up, the pale belly blends into the bright sunlight of the sky. And so it's much less visible. So it's kind of camouflage on two fronts. But I think that, you know, even despite that camouflage and all the plumage features, probably the best way and the easiest way to identify the common sandpiper is by their behavior. Because like some of the other birds we mentioned already, they have this really curious habit of bobbing their tails almost constantly. They just can't stay still. And that's not something you see other waders doing. So if you see a wader just constantly bobbing its rear end up and down, it looks like they're teetering back and forth, it's going to be a common sandpiper. Unless you're very lucky and you've seen a vagrant spotted sandpiper, which is the North American counterpart, which is very similar, but in the breeding plumage, they have these white blotches or white spots on their chest, a bit like a thrush in a way. So yeah, they're the only birds that do that in this wader family, which I find really quite interesting. Nobody knows why they do it, but it seems to be a common recurring theme among these river birds.
We've got to get to the bottom of that and we'll figure it out. They have a beautiful call, very wader, like you know straight away if you heard some evening over a river or nighttime over a river that it's wader, but you might know it's a common sand, but let's play it now.
It. Yeah, and again, another very sharp call, very insistent, something that cuts through the sound of rushing water. Again, the common theme again, we're finding these birds we're talking about, they're all fairly, you know, unrelated to each other, and yet they have so many similar characteristics, including their voices, which I think is quite interesting.
Another thing I've read about them in a couple of places, and I've heard this talked about for other species, but is it or is it not true that the youngsters, the chicks basically, can cling on to the mum and she can fly them to sort of safety if there is danger inbound?
This is something you hear, all right, and it's very hard to document. It certainly has been recorded several times in a related species called the woodcock, where the little chicks will nestle in between mum and dad's legs. They squeeze their legs together and they fly off with these little chicks in situ. It would stand to reason that birds like common sandpipers may occasionally do that. Their chicks are very vulnerable. Unlike the chicks of most birds, they look after themselves from day one. They come out of the egg already pretty much able to run around. They find their own food from day one. They're what we call precocious or precocial birds. They're very well developed when they come out of the egg. That means, however, they often get themselves into a spot of bother. They'll run off from mum and dad trying to find food, so the parents are trying to keep a close eye on them and see where they've gone to. And they're very vulnerable to predators. They attract attention. So it may be the case that, yeah, the parents do have to make a rapid escape, so mum might tuck the bird in under her legs and fly off. Again, it's very hard to document this. As I said, we do know it happens for sure with woodcock. I've heard speculation it may well happen with common sandpiper as well.
It's a lovely adaptation, if they're able to. That's cool. That wraps up our sort of famous five river birds. I think there is other birds that could be considered river birds or species in that sort of, I don't know, potentially mute swans, maybe cormorants, and anything else up your way?
Well, where I am in Wicklow, one that I would associate with the rivers here would be the goosander, this really unusual looking duck. I remember the sawbill group. They have these long, pointed, thin, narrow beaks, very unlike a typical duck beak, with this sort of rows of serrations, like the teeth of a saw along the edges. That's an adaptation for grabbing fish. And they're breeding now in the waterways just around Wicklow and perhaps into County Carlow as well. They nest up in holes in trees, actually, in nest boxes. But apart from that, you usually find them on fast-flowing streams. So that's another bird I would very much associate with rivers. And of course, along rivers, you have lots of vegetation growing. So there's birds that we might not necessarily think of as being just solely river birds, but if you have reeds or sedges, you'll get sedge warblers in there. You'll get willow warblers and chiffchaffs feeding along those. You'll get meadow pipits. All sorts of birds use those habitats. So it really is important that we value our wetlands and particularly our waterways in Ireland. I think that they've sort of been underappreciated for far too long. We tend to ignore them. We tend to abuse them. So much pollution ends up in them. They tend to be diverted and culverted, and nobody really pays much attention to the vegetation along their banks. But they're actually real repositories for wildlife, and not least the birds. I think they definitely deserve a lot more respect than they get.
Yeah, hopefully we're waking up a bit to that and we're copping on and we're learning from our past mistakes and getting on with them. People aren't accepting that sort of carry on anymore, so onwards and upwards, I suppose. And let's hope people are seeing lots of the species we're talking about, because if they're, you know, they can indicate that healthy water that we're all looking for and we want, and it's great. So let's wrap it up there. Really enjoyed that episode. Looking forward to the next few episodes. We've got some exciting ones ahead. We've got one on bird flu because it's quite timely at the minute. We're going to talk about bird flu next week. We're going to visit Cape Clear. And barn owls is on the agenda as well. So people love owls. So I expect that'll be a popular episode. So Thanks, Ned.
Yeah, thanks, Ricky. And just to say to everyone listening to us here now, if you're interested enough to listen to us prattle along about birds for the last while, you're exactly the kind of person we need to convince to join Birdwatch Ireland. We're a charity, and all of the great work that you hear us talking about, that our colleagues undertake, and all the surveys and all the conservation projects, we can't do that without your help. Birds do need the support. So we'd really appreciate it if you join us as a member. You can find full details at birdwatchireland.ie, and it's a great way to help birds, help the environment, help biodiversity, and help some very worthwhile projects. And just to finish by saying, the In Your Nature podcast is produced in partnership with the Heritage Offices of Leash and Offaly County Councils, supported by the Heritage Council and Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage. And this podcast is edited by Anne-Marie Kelly.